sister, and hear me, brother, too. This song contains a message, and it might apply to you. There's a little bit of gay in everyone today.
Very anthem-sounding song is also very obscure. It's from 1972 by an English group called Everyone Involved, and the album was called Either Or. They only pressed 1,000 copies of it and gave most of them away. The song was appropriately called a gay song, and it's one of the earliest openly gay songs to be released. You're listening to Queer Voices on KPFT, and this segment is called Queer Music Heritage. I'm J.D. Doyle, and the rest of tonight's show will explore the music of two other artists who had openly gay recordings in the early 70s. The second artist we'll hear about is Chris Robison, and I've got a special interview with him. Besides releasing his own very gay albums, his career was wide-reaching and, for example, involved working with Keith Richards, John Phillips, the New York Dolls, and John Lennon. We'll hear from him a little later. But first up is Michael Cohen, a New York City singer-songwriter who self-released his own album in 1973, and then the same year released another album, this time carried by the very reputable Folkways label. His albums were among the first with openly gay lyrics. Frankly, I wish I knew more about him, and my internet searches have come up dry, so all I have to go by are the liner notes from his three albums. My first exposure to Michael Cohen was his Folkways album, called What Did You Expect? It's a good-looking album, with a large photo of Cohen on the front. He's got bushy hair and a beard. And inside is a nice 6-page booklet of the lyrics. And there's a sticker on the cover, obviously placed after printing, that says, Songs sensitively and honestly dealing with the experiences of being gay. Written and sung by this brilliant young artist. I'm going to start off with the gayest song on the album, The Last Angry Young Man.
Love to me.
The lyrics of many of the other songs on the album are very poetic, full of imagery, and often you wonder what on earth he means by his words, like this one called Bitter Feast.
My lover Peterson, he called me Golden Mouth, and I changed him to a bird, and he migrated south. My lover Friedrich wrote sonnets to my breast, and I changed to a horse, and he galloped on west. My lover Jonathan, he named me Bitter Feast, and I changed him to a serpent, and he wriggled. My lover, I'd forgotten, the one who named me Death. Well, I changed him to a catfish, and he swam up north. My lover, I imagine he cannot form a name, and I will nestle in his fur and never be to blame, and never be to.
I mentioned that Michael Cohen had two albums in 1973, and I'm guessing the other one was actually released first, as it was self-produced and obviously self-released, as the liner notes on the back are handwritten. It's also self-titled, and it's interesting that it's just called Mike Cohen instead of Michael Cohen. I'm betting that when he landed the Folkways deal, he decided to be a little more formal. Also, five of the songs on the first album also ended up on the Folkways album, but with new, more professional recordings. Here's a track from the first album that wasn't repeated. It's called Danny in the Central Park Snow, and is the only song by him with a country feel to it.
Yeah, I want to dance on your memory. I want to break all the myths in my mind. I want to sing my song for you lovingly. It is you that I'm longing to find. It's you that I'm longing to find. So if you head west come the winter, don't you be forgetting the snow. Don't you want the park to be glistening. You're the man that I know. You're the love that I know. Well, I learned from my bitter beginnings some words that best left unspoken, lest you be a token. So you edit the thoughts of one lifetime like a tape from some splicing machine. your right place. But some truth emerges within my words, some truth that I hardly had seen. Well, it's something that I hardly had seen. Someday you see me a wanderer on a street or an artist renowned. Won't you come on back and make love to me? I will harbor this dream that you're found. I will harbor this dream that you're found. We all learn from our bitter beginnings. Some words are best left unspoken, lest you be a token. Okay, I wanna dance on your memory. I wanna break all the myths in my mind. I wanna sing this song for you lovingly. It is you that I'm longing to find. It's you that
that was called Danny in the Central Park Snow from the album just called Mike Cohen. Another interesting song from both of the 1973 albums is one called Orion.
I've been digging up the ruins from all the high school years. Gym block fantasies and the mad masturbation fears, and no one ever knowing why a song seems so strong like me always had a streamlined tear stuck in his eye. Bobby, I can't remember the night I fell in love with you at the cabaret, singing about the rage and the war and the wrath for God we knew. We took a walk with smoke and joint, our palpitation pulse repeated it, overwhelming me soulfully, the common thread. And I'll say a prayer for you now. You'd love me if you only knew how. Now you're on a crusade, me on a gay plate. We'll get together somehow, my love. We'll get together somehow.
Michael Cohen had one other album, and it was also on the Folkways label. It came out in 1976 and was called Some of Us Had to Live. It is also full of lots of poetry and imagery, and to my reading, no openly gay lyrics, but I kind of like its closing track called In a Dream Again.
Stop by in a dream again. You're really quite a call. Waves playing tricks on me. Whenever I'm off guard, to find me with a growth of beard and a body drugged and numb from memory loss and contact fear, and living on the run from songs of you to songs of Sue. No, I've never really changed. Same old chords and the same old blues. they've just been rearranged. Won't you set me free to love again? Oh, you make my life so hard. 5 years and 3,000 miles, sweet friend, of catching me off guard. I don't claim to have an alibi. No, I just hide behind my hair when I look down and release the tie that held my sanity threadbare. Once again, I kneel down in a mist. Pray that you will leave, but my prayers are easy to resist, and my heart is on my sleeve. La 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 la.
All three albums by Michael Cohen are very rare, especially the self-released one. But fortunately for collectors, the Folkways albums are now available on CD. In an amazing project of the Smithsonian Institute, they acquired the complete recordings of Folkways, and any of their 2,168 albums can be ordered on CD online. And that includes several other gay titles, like the historic Walls to Roses album and another called Gay and Straight Together. This is a good time to invite you to check out my site at www.queermusicheritage.com. If you visit it while you're listening, you can see the playlist and follow along while looking at photos of the artists and recordings. I've always considered our music history as a visual as well as an audio experience. Also, for more very queer programming, please listen to After Hours with Jimmy Carper, now in its new time every Friday night, Saturday morning from 1 to 4 a.m. on KPFT. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. I'm sure you instantly recognize that song, as it was a huge smash hit in 1969 for a group called Steam. That's where I'm starting my interview with Chris Robison. What was the first rock act that you were involved with that had some success?
It depends on what you mean by success, but I think Steam was a pretty successful group. They had a big hit song called Na Na Hey Hey, Kiss Him Goodbye, which sold about 4.5 million records around the world. That was written by a guy by the name of Paul Leka, L-E-K-A. And this guy, Paul Leka, would just record songs and just put them out there with different names. And if it hit and took off, then he would go out and get a bunch of people who were already in a band and say, okay, you guys are going to be the Lemon Pipers, for example. Lemon Pipers was his name for a song called Green Tambourine, which was a big hit. So, although there really was never a band originally Steam, we were Steam in as much as we went out on the road and played, you know, 3 weeks at a time, one night stands.
That must have been a great experience.
Well, it was very interesting. We would go out and we would go and play places like Enterprise, Alabama, and Washington, North Carolina, and all through the South, the Midwest, and do different shows on TV. Like, you know, it was a very big song. And, it was really good training, I guess.
This would have been around 1969. How old were you?
Right, 69 through 21.
After Steam, what came next?
After Steam, I joined a group by the name of Elephant's Memory. And Elephant's Memory is a band out of New York who, the joke is that half the musicians in New York City played in that band at one point. I joined that band in 1970, and I was with them two different stints. Each one was about a year.
Your specialty was what, keyboard?
At this point, it was keyboards, but I also played guitar in that band. And
your first stint in Elephant's Memory, did you record with them, or?
No, at that point, I didn't record with them, but we toured, again, all over the place. At that point, they were very politically motivated because they had had a house in Spring Valley, New York, which is just upstate a bit. It was burned down just for the sole reason that they were long-haired, sort of hippie-type musicians, and that sort of radicalized their way of looking at things. And when John Lennon came up, that's the reason why I was telling you about the activist period that they had. And when I was in the band the first time, we played for, you know, Puerto Rican Liberation Front and all these sort of things like that. But so when John came over to America to live, he was met at the airport by Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, who were early sort of radical. This is during the Vietnam War, and they were politically active people, and they brought John down to meet the Elephant's Memory in New York, and John took out his guitar and started playing Loose Weight Shoes, and the rest of the band just joined in, and that was it. They were the backup band. So as a backup band, they did a lot of stage work with John, and then they recorded John's album Sometime in New York, which is the only Beatle album that didn't sell enormous amounts of copies. And in exchange for recording with John on John's album, John and Yoko recorded the Elephant's album after that, which was would be their third album.
And so you were sort of obliquely involved with that album, though, right?
Yes, I was. What happened was I sort of tend to stay with a band for 9 or 10 months and go off. And I was with Elephant's Memory the first time, and I was approached by a guy by the name of Velvet Turner, who was Jimi Hendrix's little brother and sidekick and protege. He whisked me off to Los Angeles, where I did an album with them and did about a year's gig with them. When I came back to New York, I immediately got back together with my friends at Elephant's Memory. The drummer, Rick Frank, was my best friend, and they had asked me point blank, hey, come on back into the band. And I said, well, you know, I need just a little bit of a rest, you know, before I get into a band again. And I swear, if it wasn't the very next day, it was a day soon thereafter that when I went over to Rick's house, he pulled me in his door and he said, listen, Chris, we just met with John Lennon and we're his backup band now. So I sort of went into a state of shock there for a moment. And I said, well, you know, I said real sheepishly, well, I'll come back in your band now. And he said, oh, no, Chris, I can't do that now. We're just his backup band. But we'll be doing some songs that we had written together. And I did get to work with John in the studio. So obliquely, as much as I worked and met and sang backup with John on some of the Elephant's songs and also a couple of those tunes on the Elephant's album, which was produced by John Yoko, a couple of those tunes were co-written by me, as I said. And if you look at the credits on that, you'll see that on Power Boogie, for example, John plays guitar on my song and he sings, and so does Yoko. Yoko also sings on my song, which is kind of neat.
To have John Lennon produce and sing on one of your songs.
So when I say that I work with John Lennon, absolutely I did, but sometimes I get sort of backlash saying, oh, well, I don't see you on the cover, and you weren't on the TV shows, and that's true, but I floated in and out of many different bands, and it was my greatest thrill to be able to work with John and Yoko. Very nice people.
Let's do the Power Boogie! From a New York down to L.A., yeah. And now we like to see you moving everyone, everybody this way. And there ain't no reason why you can't all boogie today, yeah. Get off, get it on, kick off the shoes. Take it through the whiteout, you got nothing to lose. Power boogie,
power boogie.
We'll do the power boogie,
power boogie.
Yeah, yeah,
From 1972 on the Beatles' Apple label, that was little of the song Power Boogie, a song by the group Chris Robison worked with, Elephant's Memory. Chris doesn't appear on that track, but he co-wrote it and John and Yoko produced it and sang backups, which is not too shabby. In 1973, Chris released his first solo album, called Chris Robison and His Many Hand Band. This is the album I first heard about as a collector of openly gay recordings, as it contains the very gay song, Looking for a Boy Tonight. Remember, this was 1973, very early for material of this nature. Tell me about the making of your first solo album.
I had All the Way Along. It's been kind of wild and crazy. I've never hidden my sexuality to any of the bands that I was in. And it just got to the point where I thought, well, I've written all of these songs on gay subjects and gay themes because that's, of course, a major part of my life. And I had a manager called Hal Wilson, and this is just the time when it was fashionable to be bisexual, fashionable to be into glitter rock, and fashionable to tease one's public about your sexuality. But
what year was this?
This would be 1972. 1972, Hal Wilson, my manager, said, why don't you do these songs on a gay album? You can do it as well as anyone, and you're actually, you know, not a poser, as it were. So we went and recorded a couple of songs and brought them around to different places to see if we get some backing on them. Of course, people were just freaked out. Executives at companies were just not ready for that sort of thing.
They just wouldn't listen to it, wouldn't hear about it, what?
Well, they wouldn't, they weren't ready for a gay album by an artist who is really a musician first and not some kind of flamboyant sort of performer.
So they weren't ready for an artist as opposed to an act.
That's right. That, you know, someone who sort of titillates and, you know, the bearded lady or whatever. And they weren't ready for just playing music.
Did you view it as a political act?
Well, you know, I really didn't. I didn't think of it as a political act. And for me, I just wanted to write songs that were me. No, I didn't think it was political. You know, for me, it was just freedom. It represented freedom for me.
So you had resistance from record labels. How did you finally get the album recorded?
Well, I got a loan. I went to a studio with a very good rate, and because I can play all those instruments anyway, I went around and recorded the whole first album within 20 hours. And I would go and play the piano on each song, and then I'd go and put the bass on each song in a row, and then put all the drums on each song in a row. In other words, just put it together the best I could.
So you called it Chris Robison and His Many Hand Band, but it was all you.
Right. Yeah, I did all the parts, yeah.
How many copies were pressed?
Let's see. The first pressing was maybe 4,000 copies. I can't remember exactly the second pressing. I think it went into a third pressing. And we took out a small ad in a theater magazine in New York called After Dark. And in the ad, we made it was very out front in the ad, you know, having a list of names of the songs, and it said, I am not the only one to own your own sex can fun. And just so it, we had a suite, an office up on 7th Avenue, and we just sold those things all around the world. You know, it got me into a lot of trouble, to tell you the truth. I mean, on the one hand, I got to say what I wanted to say, but at that time in history or in the grand scheme of things, people just weren't that out, and Stonewall had just happened a few years before, and it was very strident and loud and angry sort of liberation.
But your album, the tone of it is so friendly.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And
it's so good-natured.
That's right. It was good-natured and friendly. because I just didn't feel like going out there and saying, you know, day is good, day is good, day is good, day is good. That wasn't the point. The point was I am who I am. So when I came along and just innocently put out this album, so it looked like a bombshell. And I got backlash, actually, from some of the gay groups because it wasn't radical enough, or it wasn't butch enough, or it wasn't, you know, it wasn't whatever group was talking at the time. It wasn't. The trouble I got into was I became a lightning rod for everyone who wanted to be out, who wasn't, or, you know, wanted to meet a gay person who didn't know anyone because no one was saying who they were.
Were you able to get gigs to promote this album?
Yes. In fact, one of the first gigs, I did some club gigs, and then I actually played in the summer of 1973 at one of the first gay rallies, Gay Pride Day, and they set up a stage right on Washington Square Park under the arch, and we played to just a packed Washington Square, and it went down beyond Washington Square and down to the side streets. I played that, and Bette Midler played directly after me.
This was, what, 73?
73, yep. June of 73.
Tell me about the song Doctor, Doctor.
Doctor, Doctor. I thought it'd be fun to do a song with a refrain, Doctor, Doctor.
Well, that's perhaps the most political or angry song on the album.
Yeah, it is pretty political, and it's a story of, you know, a man who every time he sees a young man that he's attracted to, it really rattles him, and he has to talk it over with his doctor, and the doctor just says, well, you know, and he's had electric shock therapy, and I had actually met a person on the street who had said that he had had electric shock therapy to deal with his feelings and discomfort with his sexuality, and I thought it'd be funny to make fun of that. So in the course of the song, the man actually does face up to his sexuality and desires, and instead of spending money on the doctor, the shrink, he spends money on a nice young man who's leaning against the fence and took him to dinner and had a good time. And by the end of the song, he's cured. And he's cured from going to the shrink. He's cured because he's happily gay and comfortable with his sexuality.
Why you scared them with their Freudian slips? Be well fed. You do, you have no answer to. Not
This next song we'll hear about is the one I told you about earlier. It's the very blatant, very good-natured, and very fun song, Looking for a Boy Tonight.
That's probably my least subtle song ever. And I was uptown and decided to take a bus instead of a subway. And I was sitting in the back of the bus going down Broadway. And the song just came to me because I was looking out the window and sort of cruising the street. I just wrote it, Looking for a Boy Tonight. By the time I got off the bus in Greenwich Village, it was finished.
Did that song get the most attention on the album?
Yeah, that one was the one, and that was played at all the different clubs in New York. This was straight out front, you know, straight out front. That was the one that was the easiest one to latch onto and sing along with. I used to play that at different clubs and have people singing along.
Ladies and gentlemen, the other boys in the band, pardon the expression, have asked me to take full responsibility for this song and its lyrical content. I'm looking for a boy tonight. I know to some of you out there, it may not seem quite right, but I am not the only one to know your own sex can be fun. That's why I'm looking for a boy tonight. Well, girls can be all right in their way, so long as you don't have to have them every single day. Varieties, spice of life, you all know.
Yes, I am not the only one to know his own sex can be fun. I'm looking for a boy tonight. And did you notice in the beginning where he said, ladies and gentlemen, the other boys in the band asked me to take full responsibility for this song and its lyrical content? That was a very inside joke, as you heard Chris say earlier in the interview that it was all him on the album, all the voices, all the instruments. He sure did a good job making it sound like a live performance. Tell me about Mocha Almond Boy.
Well, Mocha Almond Boy was an Italian, African, American boy in the neighborhood who I really was infatuated with. Beautiful Mocha Almond skin and beautiful curly hair. I wrote that about him again, a song that just came to me very, very fast.
Mocha Almond Boy, my Mocha Almond Joy, do you know how I feel for you? But am I just a starch white honky, an old good faggot donkey, to feel the way I do about you?
Your second album, Man Child, came out pretty quickly after the first. How would you compare the two?
Well, on Man Child's one, I used many more musicians, and it was put together over a matter of months, and I thought it would be fun to use the concept of man-child. I thought it would be fun on one side to have the man side, and then the second side, sort of a more childlike side. And
from the man side of that album, tell me about the song, I'll Be Your Man.
Oh, that's pretty angry. Yeah, that's an angry song. When I was in the city and I had, you know, my boyfriend, I would just feel no compunction at all, you know, no problem at all, just walking down the street with my arm around him and kissing broad daylight in straight neighborhoods, that type of thing. That's what I was talking about, the song. You know, why don't you just let me do what I want to do? And what's it to, why does that bother you?
And on the other side, the child side, was the song Tony Pony.
Well, if it wasn't for Tony Pony, he really was my warrior. Well, Tony Pony was a kid who I met on the street, and he was basically a throwaway kid by the age of 14 from New Jersey. And I took him in, and he lived with me for many years, and I taught him how to play music. And he taught me how to just go for it and not be afraid.
You are my Tony Boy, lying on my floor. You are my Pony Boy. May I have just one ride more? You are my Tony Boy. You are my Pony Boy. Don't you ride away now. Don't you ride away now. Say you'll stay.
Don't
On the back of that album is a small picture of two guys nude with a guitar in front of them.
Yeah. Tony, that's me and Tony. And I remember Tony cursing me out for that. I mean, we went to a session, and Hal Wilson, my manager and partner in this endeavor, did a lot of album covers. He's an artist, and he did a session with us, and it got a little bit wild. And he said, okay, sort of like when you see on TV one of the guys saying, he's snapping all the pictures of the model, you know. So, good baby, okay.
Right.
You know? Again, you know, take this off. So pretty soon, we were nude, and he kept snapping. But poor Tony Point says, damn, that picture, you never told me you were going to put that picture on the album. I had to scratch it off before I showed that album to my mother.
You sent me several demo songs, and I don't know the time period they're from. For example, Southern Philly Boy.
Well, let's see, I wrote that probably around 1975.
So shortly after Manchild, then.
Right, that was supposed to be on the third album, which I now am going to finish up and put together. And that third album was going to be just sort of more folk and more pretty, just more relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
And that song is about Tony as well.
Tell me a little more about that song.
It's just a celebration of a feeling that you have for someone. I had just met Tony and had talked to some of the things that Tony had to go through and kids have to go through in order to sort of survive. You know, even today, I guess, people, if they come out to their family, are just, you know, disowned. Tony was a throwaway kid, and the idea that a kid has to come to New York, the kid would run away and come to New York and then try to survive. Well, how does he survive? Well, he might be on the street, he might meet up with someone who might get into hustling or prostitution, but if he's lucky, he's going to meet up with someone who really takes an interest in him as a person, not just, you know, just sexually, but takes an interest in him as a...
To be a mentor.
Yeah, the mentor. Yeah, it goes back to the old ancient Greek time when the older in Sparta, it was completely institutionalized. You have a 26-year-old guy who would take a younger lover and be his teacher, his mentor, all that, all in one thing together. So that was a bit of a dangerous song.
Southern Philly boy hitchhiked the highways aimlessly. Southern Philly boy, come to the city to live with me. I don't know why I feel this way, but I think we got something that'll last more than one day. Southern Philly boy, Southern Philly boy, Southern Philly boy. Me and my Southern Philly boy drive up north on a Thanksgiving night. The car breaks down in the middle of a storm. There ain't nobody, no help in sight. We stick out a thumb just in time to catch a ride on home to the Thanksgiving dinner side. Turkey and cranberry sauce, a little sister and two, my lover and you, Southern Philly boy. Southern Philly boy, Southern Philly boy, Southern Philly boy, Southern Philly boy, Southern Philly boy. La 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 la
jump a train right to the city and lose yourselves on the streets so dirty. Find a man who is willing to stand outside the law and take your hand on through the trouble that racks your mind and keeps you running until he finds his Southern Philly boy. Southern Philly boy. Southern Philly boy. Southern Philly boy.
Did you have trouble with people who misunderstood your lyrics as, and they took it to be more of a man-boy love?
Yeah, but that's probably my own fault, you know. It's just, I guess, where does this radio show go? All over the world?
Yeah. It's Netcast.
Lovely, lovely, lovely. Well, I think that the whole man-boy thing, I mean, I'm not going to talk about that whole thing, but with me, it was not really a sexual thing. Tony and I, in those days, were not lovers. We were just, you know, very close. But it's more of a, in my head, you know, it's sort of like, to protect or to relate. Yeah, I probably got into a little trouble with that, but, you know, it wasn't so politicized then. It wasn't so, demonized. It wasn't so, you know, that's the type of thing that people like Anita Bryant sort of used. They used this idea of a homosexual being a child. They used that to galvanize the troops, as it were, and to build what is now the Christian right that kind of runs this whole country.
In 1974, there was also a 45 on the Buddha label called I'm Gonna Stay With My Baby Tonight, which I consider one of your finest works. Tell me about it.
Well, that took about 7 minutes to write. I sort of wrote it, and then I hummed it over the phone to Hal Wilson, and he said, Chris, we have to record that right away. And we did. I recorded it with Elephant's Memory as a backup. He immediately got it with Buddha Records. The only problem with that was that Buddha Records was on shaky financial ground at that time and kind of folded soon thereafter. We recorded about 13 different versions around the world. Done by George McRae as a disco version.
Really?
Ronnie Spector did a version of it. She's from the Ronettes, and she did a really kick-ass version of it.
Yeah, I like her version.
Yeah, I kind of like that too. And then it was done by a band called Sticky Patch out of South Africa. There's endless versions of it. It has not been a hit in the United States. I still get royalties from around the world on it.
No, of course, that wasn't Chris singing that one. That was Ronnie Spector of the Ronettes from her Siren album from 1980. I also love Chris's version, and I'm saving that for later in the show. Okay, moving to 1975, you toured with the New York Dolls in Japan.
Yeah, sure did. That was fun. Kind of odd because they're more popular than I knew. I mean, people today, if I tell them that I played with John Lennon and recorded with Keith Richards, they say, uh-huh, and then I tell them I worked with New York Dolls. They say, you worked with the New York Dolls?
They were kind of breaking up at that time?
Yeah. Well, they had been breaking up right along.
Constantly breaking up.
Constantly breaking up, and, you know, they'd lose a member to heroin, lose another member to something else. But that was a fabulous gig. We went over there, played on tour with Jeff Beck, Skin Yardbirds.
Yeah, I think Tokyo Dolls Live is an album.
Yeah, it was an album that was put out by a fan club.
Tell me about Stumble Bunny.
Stumble Bunny. Don't you think that's a terrible name for a band?
Where'd you get that name?
I don't know. I just pulled it out of the hat. I was just out of the New York Dolls at that time. It's kind of not fun being without a band if you're used to being in a band. So I marched myself down to Max's Kansas City, which was the local place where everyone played. And because I knew the booking agents and it just been in the Dolls, I kind of like told the kid, I said, I got this brand new band. And its name is Stumble Bunny. Yeah, Stumble Bunny, that's his name. And we need a booking, so book us as soon as you can. And so the first available booking was a few months from then. And they booked the band, and then I put the band together afterwards, after the fact.
And you released an EP?
Yeah, what happened is, after I finished recording with John Phillips and Keith Richards, I got a big chunk of money for recording with them. But we did an EP with four sides to it. And then I got a whole bunch printed up, and the bass player and I just went up and down Tin Pan Alley, all up and down 6th Avenue, to every single office in the music business, and just sort of handed them out to every record company like they're Frisbees. And then we got a call from one guy named Richard Broderick, who was associated at that time with Sire Records, and Sire Records to people like the Bangles and Robert Gordon. And he just said, hey, if you can do this song and put out that record, you sign. I want to sign you.
Well, he's got a long history of production success with Strange Loves the Angels, the Go Groups.
Right. He put all those together. He's a guy from the Bronx, and I Love Candy. Boom, 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 boom. That was a hit. He produced us, and through him, I got to play on different albums of people who were working with at the time, like Robert Gordon, who's a rockabilly fella, and Link Ray. Richard Goddard was producing those people at that time. It came out in Germany. It was pressed in Germany and Holland. I liked that album. And we went and we supported it on tour in Germany and England, second billing to the Hollies.
From that album, tell me about Young Stuff.
Yeah. I was on Grove Street, and all the sort of the kids in the neighborhood, the teenagers, would come over and hang out at my place. But Marky, he's still around in the neighborhood. Marky said, well, see ya, Chris. I'm going to go out. I'm going to go down to the yard, which was PS 41, public school on 11th Street and 6th Avenue. Said, I'm going to go down and check out the Young Stuff. I said, ooh, what a good expression, Young Stuff. I went over to Rick Frank, the drummer of Elephant's Memory, and we decided that was a really good concept for a song, and we wrote the song based on him saying Young Stuff. I even gave him credit for coming up with the idea.
Hey, Young Stuff, what's the fuss? I got your act on the crosstown bus. Hey, Young Stuff, now don't you blush. You can tell me, lover, when you think. Young Stuff, don't you give me no run around. I promised your mother you won't have to leap down. Young Stuff, come on, let me take it on home. I'm a big bad dog, you're my brand new bone. Yes, you are. Hey, Young Stuff, come on over to my side of town. Sugar, where that hot stuff goes down. I don't have to tell you, baby, you know I've been around. I'll do all my talking without making a sound. Young Stuff, don't you give me no running ground. I promised your brother you won't have to leave town. Young Stuff, come on, let me take it on home. I'm a big bad. We'll be right back. Hey, young stuff, what do you think now?
Now that you're facing the heavens without reaching the clouds.
Now that you've experienced my cannibal growl.
Come around more often and I'll make you a howl. Young stuff,
don't you give me no.
That was Young Stuff from the album by Chris's group Stumble Bunny from 1979. The album was called While You Were Out. I think it's an excellent album, and it's unfortunate it was only released in Germany. What did you do musically during the 80s?
During the 80s? Well, unfortunately, when my alcoholism and substance abuse caught up with me about 81 or so, 82, then I worked very hard to rehabilitate myself. I even went to a rehab out in Minneapolis. But unfortunately, I didn't quite make this sort of cut off between that and music. In other words, it was so wrapped up with the scene and sort of what goes on. It's hard to be in the music business, at least in those days, and not be confronted at every turn with alcohol and all that. So I sort of threw away the baby with the bathwater as far as performing. And then I always wanted to be a father, and I thought that, well, now that I'm sober and straight in the program, this is the time to do it. And I had a girl friend who, a strange, enchanted girl, like I said, and she was friends with Peter Allen, the performer, and made clothes with Peter Allen, and she just accepted me for who I am, who I was. We proceeded to have a couple of kids, two boys. But so during those years, to answer your question, I sort of focused more on children's songs because, hey, I was at home taking care of the kids. I took my cue from John, who stayed home with the kids while Yoko worked. And my wife had a clothing store, which I backed. She would work that, and I'd stay home with the kids, and we'd come up with children's songs. And that led to a children's album later on.
That album was 1994, yeah. Under the name Papa Chris Major?
Papa Chris Major.
Your family name?
Yeah, my family name. But Hal Wilson had said to me, and it might have been true at that time, but Chris, he said, the gay market and the children's market don't mix.
Are those your kids on the cover of the CD?
Yeah, those are my two children. Right? And they sing on it, too.
Your partner on the album, Steve Farrell?
Yeah.
Is he gay?
Yes.
It was a sort of a gay children's album.
Yeah, I guess it was. It was, but
not marketed that way.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know gay artists now who have children's albums.
Yeah, why not?
Right.
Absolutely. And that's the way it should be. You know, in the old days, it just was a struggle to sort of announce one's gayness, and that was also very exotic. But as life goes on, it's just part of the fabric of society.
Sing, sing as I do. Sing, sing as I do. Sing, sing as I do. your hands up, I'll be waiting. When you take your hands away, I'll be there. And you know I'll always be there for you. And you know I'll always be there for you.
And that track was called See Me, See You, and is from Chris's critically acclaimed children's album from 1994. He and his music partner Steve Farrell released that under the name Papa Chris and Steve. Of which of your recordings in your career are you the most proud?
Many Hand Band and Manchild. Those are the ones that let me really be myself.
Are there any questions I should have asked you?
Well, you know what? I do think that sort of like the Tale of Two Cities, you know, how it starts out and says, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. And I think about that in context of gay life. And although you can say, well, yes, gay is on TV and gay is accepted and gay, you know, made great strides in the past 20 or 30 years, it really is also a very horrendous time for gay people because of the political climate and homophobia. And I think the fact that gayness is out there and recognized, and it, especially in high school and college, it can actually put more of a danger to some people, because straight people are more threatened, and straight people are more inclined to dehumanize people, because, you know, gay is an entity, gay is something which is recognizable, gay is easy to say, okay, let's beat up, let's hang someone on a fence because they're gay, you know. So in other words, when it was less out front, that might have been safer in some ways. And that troubles me, and so I'm very proud and ready to go back out there and do these albums again and play and promote and say, you know, screw you, anyone who doesn't like it. But I'm gay, I'm gonna say I'm gay, and even to speak to what we touched on before about love between people of different ages. I don't really care. I think people need support, you know, and I definitely need to support myself and say what I want to say out there. And so best of times and worst of times. You know, people are running for the hills and they're running for shelter, a lot of them, except for some very brave people in the political spectrum. People like yourself who have a show that's really out there doing the service to the community. So I think I'm doing the right thing, and I feel proud doing it.
Now that his kids are grown, Chris is ready to devote more time to his music and plans on releasing his third solo album this year. You can learn more about that and his career at www.chrisrobison.net. Now I've got one more song to share with you, and before I get to it, I want to thank you all for listening, and to thank Chris Robison for the interview. And as always, if you have questions or comments about any of the music I featured, please write me at qmheritage@aol.com, and I wish you would. My website, of course, is at www.queermusicheritage.com. This is J.D. Doyle for Queer Voices on KPFT in Houston. I'm closing the show with one of my favorites of Chris's songs, and it's been covered by a number of artists. You heard a bit of Ronnie Spector's version earlier, but now you'll hear it by Chris Robison. From 1974, here's I'm Going to Stay with My Baby Tonight.
I'm Tonight.